We better get started or we'll never finish.
It's the job that's not begun that takes longest to finish.
Yeah.
Anybody know where that's from?
No.
The Bible.
That was a safe answer at church. Who said it? Well, Jesus must have said it. No, it's from Tolkien. It's from the first book, The Fellowship of the Ring. And that's what Samwise Gamgee says his father always said. It's the journey that's, it's the job that's not begun, it takes longest to finish. So. All right. So. As I work on these lessons for you, I'm learning a lot myself that I didn't know before, and so we've kind of gone in some directions that I had not originally anticipated going in. And with that in mind, last week we talked about idealism, and I thought we were kind of all done with idealism, but then as I was trying to move into the next portion of the lessons, I learned some more about idealism that I thought were worth at least briefly highlighting for you. So if you remember from last week, idealism is a framework that sees Revelation as an entirely spiritual telling. The book is a metaphorical book almost entirely, and once again, of course, with some exceptions, and within the idealist movement, there are variations and individuals who have slightly different takes. So these are somewhat generalized in nature. But idealism is a looking at the book of Revelation from a application that says that this book is metaphorical, allegorical, is telling us a story. It relies heavily on symbolism from all the numbers and such. And we talked a lot about that last week. It's telling a redemptive arc history of the church and of Jesus' work. We talked about all of this last week. It's generally amillennial, meaning it does not believe that there's a millennium. There's no tribulation coming. There's no 144 selection of Jewish members. These are numbers that are given to show the entirety of the church. There's no specific antichrist. We talked a lot about that last week, but I found a few more details that I thought were worth bringing to you. One of the things I thought was really important is that, in general, if you could find a way, a theme, a starting point of how an idealist looks at Revelation, the books that they write about it, etc., they will emphasize this point, that it is a book about Christ's triumph. That Revelation is a book about Christ's triumph, his triumph over Satan, his triumph over sin and death, etc. It generally takes a fairly optimistic view of things. It believes that the book of Revelation, this is one of their arguments for this framework, is that the book is timeless and that it's not written for just one period of Christian readers. They would argue that the preterist's view, that the problem with the preterist view is that, well, that makes the book really only relevant if it's all about the past. It really only makes it relevant to the ones who read it before the event happened, and that everybody who's come since then, what's the point? If everything in Revelation is done as of AD 70, what's the significance of the book for those of us who follow? So the idealist would argue against the preterist from that perspective. They also argue against the futurist, because then they say, what's the purpose of the book for everybody who's existed up until the point when the future finally happens? So I don't think that's a strong argument, of course, because then what's the point of any prophecy? You know, what's the point of what God told Eve in the Garden of Eden? You know, so that prophecy took 4,000 years before it finally happened. So I don't feel like that's as strong an argument, but that is a idealist's argument for their interpretation, is that it makes the book timeless and valuable for everyone. As they look at this Christ's triumph framework. You see that they see the book is telling first century Christians all the way to now what the struggles of life are about. That they're about this victory over sin. They're about Christ's ultimate victory. They're a telling, an allegory, a metaphor of what church life is going to be like. There's going to be persecution. There's going to be victory. It's back and forth. The white horse that we see, you know, in the four horsemen of the apocalypse that futurists look towards. And how many of you know what's the first horse? Does anybody remember? It's a white horse. And who do futurists claim is on the white horse?
The Antichrist.
The Antichrist coming with the bows, but establishing a peace, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the idealists believe that that's Jesus' horse, that he's the first horseman of that. But that those other horses are emblematic of the wars that are happening, of the famine that happened, of death that's happening, and continues to happen in the world. It describes a future, although some of what it's describing is past. So when it was written, so when we who are futurists come to an idealist and say, well, but this book is prophecy, it says it's prophecy. What do you do with that as an idealist? Well, the idealist says, well, yes, we believe it's prophetic in the sense that it's exploring and creating an allegory of things that are and will be happening in a general format. That the book is not at all ever specifically about specific events. Okay? And you can look at the extremes. You can have a historicist who says, hey, when the locusts come out of the pit, that's the Muslims invading Spain. Very specific historic event. Or you can go to the other extreme where the idealist who says, that's simply about the struggle that we have against evil in the world. And so you have these kind of two extreme viewpoints of it either being very specific or it being just very broad and generalized. Okay, so they see it as prophetic in that sense, that it is highlighting occurrences and interactions of the church and of the Christian people in the world, but not by a specific exact event being predicted. Part of my struggle with this, then, is that this is what I would call, this is just Ed McBroom calling it this, so, but I would call this safe prophecy. Okay? This is taking away any danger for God. Okay? God lives dangerously, is my experience, when it comes to prophecy, right? The Old Testament, he prophesies very specific things. Okay? There's the vision that the Pharaoh has. Joseph goes and interprets the dream. Baker, you are going to be dead. Wine tester, you're going to be reinstated. Really dangerous prophecies, right? Because they're very specific, and if they don't go right, you're very clearly wrong. But if instead you have a set of prophecy that's just this very big generalization about there's going to be persecution, there's going to be good times, there's going to be death, there's going to be new life.
Any Chinese fortune cookie.
So it becomes this safe prophecy for God. And I feel like this is one of kind of the blind spots of the idealistic approach, is that it gets God off of the hook for ever coming through, right? Because there's whatever happens is going to be in that large net that's been cast out there. And perhaps one of the main things that really brought me to come to you one last time about idealism, because I hadn't noticed this before, and then as I was trying to move on, one of the criticisms, of course, and we already discussed this as we discussed dispensationalism. Dispensationalism creates extra-biblical ideas of dividing history up into seven periods. And they pick seven, right? And then it's like, okay, there's innocence, there's conscience, there's civil government, there's the patriarchs, right? And we make sure we get seven because, boy, God, of course, is going to make it seven. Okay? And idealists, as I've listened to a lot of idealists talk and others who criticize dispensationalism, they talk about that kind of shoehorning of things. But I discovered that the idealists are doing the exact same thing, in my opinion, because they also see the book of Revelation as being seven. What's the word I wrote down? Seven. There it is. It's a tough word for me to remember. Seven recapitulating visions. And of course, it's got to be seven, right? It's got to be seven, okay? And so, now, I offer this as a criticism, just like I'm very critical of dispensationalism doing this as well. These are extra-biblical frameworks, okay? And that doesn't mean they're wrong. It doesn't mean they're unbiblical. But there's nothing in the Bible that tells us that you can use this. Okay, so they can be handy tools. They can help you understand. I'm okay with studying them and using them. But we need to always keep in mind that they are extra-biblical, that they are not biblically sourced frameworks. And so whether it's the dispensationalists doing that, or the historicists doing that, or the idealists doing that. And by this, seven recapitulating visions, what they're saying is that the book of Revelation can be divided up into seven specific visions that are all retelling the exact same story from seven different points of view. Okay, and just a few of these points of view specifically. There's the heavenly point of view of what's happening on earth during the church age. There's the church's viewpoint of what's happening during the church age. There's the earthly, what the people of earth are experiencing during the church age. There's these different viewpoints. And I heard one teacher describe it as, imagine you're at a football game, and you've got seven different TV cameras. You got one on the sideline, you got one on the stands, you got one on the defense, you got one on the offense. All the cameras are telling the same story from seven different perspectives. Okay? And so the idealist reads Revelation, and he has put some clear demarcations of where these seven visions start and stop, and that they are repeat. That's what by recapitulating means, that the vision starts over again and tells the same story that we already saw. So the seven letters to the churches are one vision. That's the church's viewpoint of the church age. And then you get to chapter 4, and you see heaven's viewpoint. And then you see the judgments, okay? You get to Revelation chapter 20, and what we're seeing there is another viewpoint of the church age from God's point of view. So rather than from the church, now we're seeing it from God's point of view, that Jesus has come, bound Satan, that he is no longer able to harass the nations. So, as I mentioned, I'm not saying that that's wrong. I'm not saying that it can't be right. But it is extra-biblical. It is taking a human framework and putting it over Revelation and saying, here's how we ought to understand this. And we should be careful whenever we use really extensive human frameworks, and we make everything fit very nicely in the package, and it's like, oh, it's perfect. Okay, so some problems I have with this again is that Revelation, when you read it, it's clearly an epistle. Okay, it's written in the same style as the other epistles of the New Testament, a letter from one of the apostles. It claims to be prophetic. Okay. It's claiming, it's writing to the churches and seems to be talking, when you read in the natural voice, about real things that are happening at these churches. The persecution they're experiencing, specific individuals, the Nicolaitans. It's referencing people, you know, the woman that's leading them astray in one of the churches, etc. The idealist chooses to see all of that as a metaphor, as allegorical writing and not as specific. And I believe that that's a choice that they're making. Just like I'm making a choice to read it the other way, to read it as being needed to be taken literally. So you can make these choices, but it's important that we recognize that we have to find, I think, ways to, that, the, what does the rest of the Bible, what does the way we read the rest of the Bible tell us about how we read this book? And the idealists, like I told you last week, they come to this book and they're like, hey, everything else in the Bible we should read with this methodology, the historic grammatical approach. But when we get to the book of Revelation, we change that. And rather than presume that what can be taken literally ought to be taken literally, we flip that the other way and we say, everything should be taken metaphorically unless we can't take it metaphorically. And while you can do that, I don't know what the biblical mandate is to do it that way. So that's any questions, because I'm going to move on from my ideas. I wanted to lay that out. Any questions before we move on?
What were the seven visions, recapitulating visions? You mentioned five of them.
Yeah, I didn't write down a full list. I'll try to get it for you, but some of my sources were kind of vague as to what they were particularly.
No, that's fine.
And listening to Vody Bachman is taking me a lot of time because he's got 60 hour and a half long messages on this, so
no problem.
It's taking me a long time. All right, so we're going to move on now to something I really had not anticipated, once again, doing when I began this, but I think there's some value in it as I've studied it. So we've talked now about the four frameworks. Okay, we've talked preterism, historicism, futurism, to in a contemporary sense with dispensations, and we've talked about idealism. But what is it that we can glean from what the early church understood about this and how the early church looked at end times, the book of Revelation, etc.? Well, remember, the really early church, Jesus himself, the apostles, they lived in the first century. Okay, so the Bible itself is written during the first century, which, you know, is basically 0 to 99 AD. Right? There's no zero, so it's really 1, which is why it's actually 1 to 100 is your first century, mm-hmm. and why 101 is second century, right?
Okay.
In case you're ever in a trivia show, and when does the next second century, when does the 21st century begin? It always begins on the 1 year, not on the 0 year.
Right.
Okay? So, now you have some trivia for Jeopardy. Anyway, so we want to think about what did the second century church, what did they believe about the end times? What were their views? And it's somewhat difficult to really nail it down. We don't have a lot of extant writings, but what I could find, what others have found as they put this together, some of the first things you can think about are these two groups, the Ebionites and the Algoid. These two groups are very, very fixated on Jewish culture. And to a large extent, at least based on the sources I looked into, may be very directly descended from the Judaizers and the others that Paul struggled with and the other apostles were struggling with in the early church. Algoi in particular, were very concerned about Greek influences in Christian teaching. They were really concerned about John. There's writings about how they complained about John using the word logos to describe Christ in the first chapters and first verses of John, and also in 1 John. And so there's a lot of Jewish influence still persisting in this part of the early church. But one of the things that these church members also were very fixated on, besides, and I'm not saying that these people were perfect or didn't have some problems, but They believed in a physical, millennial kingdom. Specifically, that Jesus, who they believed was Messiah, would reign, would come back, and would set up a kingdom. Okay, and so, despite some of their other beliefs that I think can face some real criticism, this was a belief of this group. And what we know about them comes from some writings of other church historians later on. And a couple of these other ones I'm going to reference also come largely from writings about other people who wrote about them, sometimes in criticism. Okay? So, one of the first church fathers that we really have reference to, who had some specific teachings that we have recorded about Revelation, is Papias. Papias of Caesarea, this is around 95 to 120, is when he was a pastor. And so he believed that what we know about him is that he believed that there would be a physical millennium, and that that Christ would return and reign, and that it would be a Jewish-based kingdom, that Jesus would reign from Jerusalem, that Jerusalem would be the center of that, and that there would be a real millennium. Why we know this, again, is from the writings of Eusebius in the 300s, who wrote that Papias had an outsized influence on the beliefs of the early church. And so from that, and specifically his viewpoints about the end times, about a millennium, etc. And so we don't have any of his specific writings, but what we have is a church historian later on coming and saying, so much of the early church in the first century believed in a millennium kingdom and in a Jewish kingdom and Jesus returning to do that, and it's because of this guy. So it's really an interesting set of history because it helps us. Because Eusebius comes along and says this was a big problem in the early church. They believed in the 1,000-year millennium. And it's this guy's fault. Okay? So after Papias, the next one that we have, and we actually have writings from, is Justin Martyr. He's often considered the first apologist. He wrote an actual writing called The Apologia. He wrote numerous other books, including one where he kind of sets up a fake situation of a fake character debating another fake character about Christianity. It's a dialogue between a Christian and a Jew, where the Christian is arguing with the Jew for why Jesus is the Messiah. This is around AD 150. Justin Martyr references Revelation very specifically, so we know that he was familiar with the book. We know that he believed in the 1,000-year physical kingdom. And he wrote specifically that at the beginning of that kingdom, there would be a resurrection of the righteous. But that's kind of all we have then. I mean, we don't have anything much more defined than that. A lot of this tends to focus around Revelation 20. Do you believe in a millennial kingdom for real or not? Next, after that, we have a man named Melito. He was the bishop at Sardis, which was one of the seven churches that received a letter in Revelation. He is the first one we know to have written a commentary on Revelation. This was about AD 65. Unfortunately, it doesn't exist anymore. It's been lost. So it's only referenced by others that we know that he did it. Would have been really interesting to have his commentary, the first one to have written an extensive commentary on the book, coming from a church that was written to in Revelation. Could see why that would have probably been really interesting. So all we can really say comes again from other historians who wrote back about Melito and say again that he believed in a physical millennium kingdom where Christ would reign. Now, something interesting happens right about this time. around AD 65, a heretic, whose name escapes me at the moment, he wrote out what books should be in the Bible. And he assigned a bunch of heretical Gnostic gospels and etc. And so other believers at the time wrote a response to that that is called the Meritorian Canon. And this would have been AD 165. This is the first published list of the books that the early church said were in the Bible, in the New Testament. And it's almost all 27 books that we use today, and it includes Revelation. So we can see from an early time period that the early church believed that Revelation was appropriately placed in the canon. It's the only apocalyptic book that they placed in the canon. There was another guy who's even less known about than Melito, Theophilus of Antioch. He was AD 160, and he referenced Revelation, and I just bring him up to say that early church fathers were referencing the book, and they were pointing to it. Theophilus, his pointing to it was in using it to argue with another heretic about what was true and what wasn't true, and he referenced Revelation in that, but we don't know much about his particular views or positions. So, moving on from these really early ones, we finally come to somebody who gives us a more extensive development, and this is a name that you probably know if you've done any church history. Tertullian. Okay, and Tertullian is about, where he does most of his work here that we're referencing, around 180. Okay, and he developed this eschatology. He's the first one that we have any writings, because some of these other guys may have done this, but we don't have their writings. But we have Tertullian's writings, and he developed a very extensive framing of Revelation. He talks about the resurrection of the righteous at the second coming. He connects Revelation to Daniel chapter 2. Does anybody know what happens in Daniel chapter 2? Daniel chapter 2.
Hmm? Is that when the scrolls are sealed away? Mm-hmm.
No, that's later. Daniel 2. Remember, Daniel's taken into captivity. Him and the other three Hebrew children, they eat vegetables, they get promoted to the service of the king, and then the big thing happens. The king has what? Nebuchadnezzar's vision, okay? And he sees the statue, right? The head of gold, the chest of silver, the waist of bronze, and the legs of clay and bronze mixed together, right? Okay, and then what happens to it?
Gets hit by a big stone.
Gets hit by a big stone that does what? After it smashes it, it does what? It grows and takes over the whole world. It becomes a mountain. Okay? And so Tertullian took this passage in Daniel chapter 2 and tied it with Revelation and said, that stone is Jesus Christ. Okay? Does this sound familiar?
Yes.
Because this is what we teach.
Yes.
Okay? That stone is Jesus Christ, smashing the kingdoms of this world and setting up his own earthly kingdom. And so Tertullian was really the first one that we have that does that sort of exegesis. Okay, connects Daniel 2, and he connects it to Jesus' second advent. Not to his first one, but that when he comes back, he'll be setting up this kingdom, that the stone will come and smash the kingdoms of this world. He believed that Rome was Babylon, referred to in the book of Revelation. He believed in a physical, real millennium kingdom that was going to come, and that it would be also, back to Daniel, that would happen at the completion of Daniel's 70th week. So that sound familiar to some of you too? Right? So we see some very familiar teachings that we, who are futurists, continue to reference coming from Tertullian. He also had a belief that the Antichrist, which If you read Revelation, you don't see the word Antichrist. Okay? You see beast, you see some other references. Where's the word Antichrist come from? Anybody know? First John. That's right. And so he, Tertullian, his exegesis said Antichrist, the beast, and the man of perdition that Paul references, or the man of sin, are all the same person. Okay? He believed that this Antichrist would be a pseudo-Christian, a false Christian, a quasi-Christian, he called it. Somebody who was in the church, came out of the church, was an apostate, basically, would be the Antichrist. And so Tertullian really laid out, in a way, kind of similar to what people do today with their books about the end times. Tertullian is kind of one of the first ones to have done this, to gone down this road that we know about. He said, there's other ones who wrote books, we don't know what they said. But we know that Tertullian did this. Now, I don't want to lead you totally astray and have you all run out there and say Tertullian was amazing, he's the most biblical, perfect church father that we have. Tertullian is largely criticized for later in his life becoming very unhappy with the church. He felt that the church was getting soft and weak on numerous points of theology, and he joined with a group called Montanists, who the church later on determined to be a heretical sect. So, I don't know what more to add than that to you, okay? The Montanists had some heretical beliefs, of which I can't specifically identify at this moment for you. I did not plan to discuss it. But they, because Tertullian joined up with them, they became very, very focused on this particular thing that he was teaching about Revelation as well. And they added that to some of their other problematic beliefs. And so one of the criticisms that futurists continue to face from non-futurists is that their beliefs come from the Montanists. Okay, that's kind of a way to easily dismiss futurists. But if, as you saw with some of these others that I put up here, and if you study the kind of the timing of Tertullian and his teaching, I don't feel like that criticism is entirely fair. So that's why I just ventured down there. So feel free to study the Montanists and where their heresies were on your own.
But you did see some based on the scriptures that were definite heresies.
So, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
That's good.
Do you remember what the Montanist big problem was? I can't remember. I think it had to do with the nature of Christ, if I remember right.
Okay.
Is that was kind of a safe guess, because most of those early heresies were around the nature of Christ.
Okay.
So
modern day heresies are too.
Well, that's true too, yes. As Gail pointed out, most modern day heresies are also circulated around the nature of Christ, so that's a fair point. Okay, so after Tertullian, the next church father that we can really reference is Irenaeus, or Irenaeus, depending on how you'd like to pronounce it. I'm not Greek. So he's about the same time as Tertullian. He had very similar beliefs to Tertullian. So we can see that this idea of a millennial kingdom, of a return of Christ, of the resurrection of the dead, these ideas, this tying to Daniel's 70 weeks of the return of Jewish authority, etc., were all very alive in the second century church. Okay, this is really commonly held beliefs amongst the church of the second century. Irenaeus, very similar to Tertullian, except that he believed that the Antichrist would be of the tribe of Dan. Okay, and that the book of Revelation, if you read the 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes, what do you know about your Bible history, your Old Testament history? How many tribes were there?
12.
Were there?
13.
13, right? 13, because why? Because Joseph's tribe gets split into two, Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay? So 13. Well, how do we get to 12? Well, Dan who sinned, and there's Old Testament dealings. We studied Judges, and we read about the Danites, right? And they were really off the reservation towards the end of the story. Okay, that guy went up north, and they were conquering their own kingdoms and everything. It got a little out of hand. And so the Danites get left off of this list. There's an Old Testament prophecy that says the Danites won't have an inheritance in the future kingdom. And so Irenaeus believed that the Antichrist would come from the tribe of Dan. That's how he exegeted that. He also, and we start to see a little change here. Irenaeus also did not believe that the millennial kingdom, which he believed was a physical, real kingdom with Jesus coming and would reign, but he did not believe that it would be set up under Jewish auspices. Okay? He believed that true Jews are those who are people of faith. Okay, and you can see where you get that from reading Romans. Okay, and that Paul talks about. We are the seed of Abraham, that true Jews are all those who have the true faith. Okay, we're going to talk a lot more about this as we get into the book, because this is a key point, I think, of deciding how you want to interpret Revelation. Is do you believe in a future for physically born Jewish people? Or do you believe that God has left the Jewish people and replaced them with the church? Okay, we're going to talk a lot more about that in the future, so I don't want to go into it in too much depth today. But Irenaeus, well, he believed that there would be a physical kingdom, as Tertullian did, and as these other ones that I had up here before did. He started to veer off from the Jewish nature of that kingdom and said that there was, that the church had replaced the Jewish king, the Jewish people. Not that the Jews were out, he wasn't anti-Jewish, but he believed that all who believe in Christ, Jew or otherwise, are the true Jews. He also, his other big claim to fame in this whole end times discussion, is that he is the one that really lays out that the book of Revelation was written and in AD 95. Now, why is this particular date important? Because there's two possibilities. It's either AD 95 or AD 65. It's either under the persecution of Nero or under the persecution of Domitian or something like that. So, from all that I've been teaching over the last several weeks, why is this distinction important? How does this help us? What happens in between these two dates?
Destruction of Jerusalem.
Right, the destruction of the temple, AD 70 is in here. And so, this is why preterists and futurists and everyone want to discuss, well, was it written AD 65 or was it written AD 95? If it's written AD 95, it's a lot harder to justify writing a book that tells you what's something that happened 25 years earlier, right? And that say that that's the only purpose of the book. So there's this, the futurist doesn't have a problem either way. He's like, that's fine, it doesn't matter to me. But to the preterist, it's much more difficult to accept this date. And Irenaeus is the earliest source that we have to give us a date for its writing. Okay. So
John would have been pretty old.
John would have been very old, yes. But we know that his other epistles, 1 John, 2 John, 3 John, he refers to himself as John the Elder by that point. And in AD 65, he would not have been very old. So, okay, so we are running out of time, and I expected to. I did not expect to quite finish this early church view. We've really kind of come to the end, though, of the second century, okay? And then, so we'll talk next week about the third and fourth century Christian viewpoints, and that's going to kind of then finally tie up what I've been laying out for you about the views of end times, how we got to where we are today, why we have these four main things, where they came from, how they came to be. So I want to tie up this early church second century with just a little bit of points about where the early church was at this point. Okay? The church, Christians, are outcasts in society. Okay? They're a tiny, tiny minority sect out of Jerusalem. Okay? They are largely tied to Jewishness. They're not, and the Jews are already not liked. So now you've got this little sect out of a larger group that nobody likes, that they're all very frustrated with. They're persecuted. At best, they're second-class citizens. Most of the followers are low-level society slaves, poor laborers, very few people moving upward in society. There's very significant Jewish overtones to everything the church does and what it believes. After all, it was a religion founded by a Jewish carpenter and Jewish fishermen, right? And so that's not to be unsurprising. And I think that it's very interesting that in light of all of that, that the earliest church here that we have records from in the second century, which is really the first century of church life after the apostles, held to this viewpoint that there was going to be a true millennial kingdom. And that they interpreted their Old Testament scriptures to teach that there was going to be a true thousand-year millennial kingdom. And when you come to our modern time periods, or when we get to even some of the others who start to change that viewpoint next week, they abandon the Jewish connection. We started, I just mentioned that, with Irenaeus, started to abandon the Jewish connection in the faith and walk away from that. There were fewer and fewer Jews in the church. There were more and more expansion of the church into the Gentile quarters. Jews were becoming less and less popular in society. Believe it or not, they actually diminished even further in society. And as they move away from that Jewish heritage, we see the theology change away from the idea of a thousand-year millennium, to the point where modern teachers today will tell you there is no reference in the Old Testament to a thousand-year kingdom. None whatsoever. They say the only thousand-year kingdom mentioned is Revelation chapter 20. And that all these things that we also, futurists who believe in a millennium, look back to the Old Testament, you know, Isaiah, Zechariah, and others, to tie in to say, yes, there is a thousand-year reign of Christ coming. They say those are just allegories for either the church age or for the time, the good times Israel had prior to Christ returning. So I just think this is really telling, okay? I'm not trying to say that this proves me right, okay? But I think that this is fascinating, that the very front end of the church, especially with its still extant leadership from the Jewish side of things, believe that the Old Testament taught there was a thousand-year kingdom coming, and that when they read Revelation, they said, there it is, it's coming. Christ is coming back, and it's going to be a kingdom. So, any other thoughts you have on either what we talked about right at the front end with idealism, or what we've talked about with the early church views? Any questions, thoughts, comments? Rotten tomatoes? No? Cool. Okay, so next week then we'll move into the third and fourth century, and that's really then going to kind of bring us home to where we started with when I started talking about early church history viewpoints, but I started around the year 1000, so we're going to get up to Augustine, and really Augustine's viewpoints on Revelation dominated then from his point on. So we have just a couple more to go. We hit Augustine, and then you can stretch that out to where we started with historicism. All right, let's have a word of prayer together. Dear Lord,